Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we have a guest in studio today. I don't have the applause sound, but we would like to welcome to the show, Nikki Mayo.
Yes.
World famous journalist and all around dope person. I don't have a bio, but...
You don't need one.
If you've listened to the Brown Liquor Report, you've heard her over there. We actually did one of our election coverage shows together there. Mm-hmm. And Nikki has been a great supporter, and I appreciate her coming on the show to help us talk about, I wouldn't call this fun. I don't know.
This is very informative.
And this is going to be, so here's what's happening. We are ending March, and March is Women's History Month, mm-hmm. so we are talking about a very important woman today,
yes.
who also died in March.
Okay.
I'm not sure I want to celebrate that.
That's not a celebration. We celebrate when Biggie died every year.
That's Biggie.
No, bull.
All right. So, anyway. And also, something very important that she did was kicked off in March, and we will talk about that later, but mm-hmm. welcome to the show, Nikki.
Hey, thank you.
So today, we're talking about Ida B. Wells. We regard her as an American Black woman hero. She's most notably recognized for leading the anti-lynching crusade at the turn of the 20th century. Her work, her research, her commitment to her work is notable. She did research about domestic terrorism. She recognized it for what it was. She analyzed what the factors were contributing to it. And although her work, you know, is well known, a lot of people don't know that it's hers. Mm-hmm. So today we're going to honor her because her work is pertinent. It resonates today as we move through, you know, Black Lives Matter and other allied movements where people are fighting for their humanity. It is the commitment. It's the dedication to figuring out not only how we feel, but also what the data states that moves our causes forward. So, Nikki, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, guys.
And we're just going to get into it. Okay. Well, where do we want to start about Miss Wells?
Let's start at the beginning. Ida B. Wells,
Mississippi.
Born in Holly Springs, Mississippi on July 16th, 1862.
Yes.
Born to James and Elizabeth Lizzie Wells.
Okay, so let's talk about born in 1862.
Mm-hmm. Born into slavery.
Born into slavery, but is definitely a part of the first generation of mm-hmm. Black people to come of age after slavery has ended. Mm-hmm. The Emancipation Proclamation is issued in 1863. The Civil War ends in 65. Lincoln is assassinated in 65 mm-hmm. and immediately. So I know that, you know, we're kind of running all through it, mm-hmm. but this is a tumultuous period of change in America where a whole economy is going to transform. It did not end. A whole economy is going to transform and people are going to emerge from slavery armed with really nothing but their dreams and their self-determination. So mm-hmm. her parents were actually successful in establishing a business. So they had more than their neighbors, if you will. They became an early example of middle class or as close to middle class as you could imagine. Mm-hmm. So Ida B. Wells' understanding of African American,
self-sufficiency
yeah. and how they live, she lived a lot better than people who might have found themselves absolutely destitute, homeless, you know, unable or finding their communities unwilling to host them. Mm-hmm. Holly Springs, Mississippi actually did spawn a small African American community that had businesses, their own economy. So she actually grew up relatively. Yeah.
So the reason why she's in that middle class is because her grandmother was raped by the slave
I'm glad you
owner.
Said raped. I looked at a video earlier today that said they had an affair.
And no, they didn't have an affair.
We don't negotiate consent here.
No. Exactly. And I need that verbiage to always be established that as long as there's a power dynamic, this was definitely a violation.
We don't negotiate consent here.
Right. So her father, James, is the son of Ida's grandmother and the slave owner. Mm-hmm. And the slave owner actually did claim James as his son. And so he was deeded property when the slave owner died.
So they had more.
Yeah, that's the reason why they had more.
To start with.
Out of this tremendous tragedy, they ended up in this situation. Now, that's a complicated history.
But we've touched on this before, and we understand that it was the, you don't want to say the luck of the draw, but one of the things that made slavery a diverse institution was that not every owner treated what was ultimately their children like property for the duration of their life. Some definitely went against that norm of either provision, intentionally freeing prior to the end of slavery, deeding land, or making it so that their children could be educated. So we do have examples of this, but that is also what contributed to defining the humanity, because you can't say that I'm an animal and a man. You have to make a choice. But all in all, and I'm glad that we put these, that you guys put those details out there, because that's what is behind the scenes, those dynamics. And people who had access to that type of investment, wealth, or anything like that, typically had a better way or fared better than those who did not get much. You know, people think that 40 acres and a mule is something people made up. It was a political idea that was killed in Congress because there was a resistance to redistributing land that used to belong to owners. Basically, we see that when it's like, you know, I don't know. I don't want to draw that conclusion or draw that comparison, but it's like they've been through enough. Let them keep their acreage. Don't give it away. Yeah. Don't use it as compensation.
Right.
But all in all, to be coming of age in the Deep South with some sort of discernible wealth did make them unique.
Right.
And then watching how she's actually using that, because she could have easily have become our kind of people and never felt that this whole anti-lynching crusade was worthwhile.
I definitely think it was, I think she was just born into her work. And there was a very pivotal situation that forced her commitment to it. But she seems to be one of those people inspired the entire time, never want to turn her heart away from her community. What's going on at the time? I think it's important to understand what Reconstruction was. It was a period of tumult and change. And initially, the president who took over after Lincoln's assassination was a Southern sympathizer. Andrew Johnson from Tennessee became president, and his first 2 years of Reconstruction were seen as pats on the, like a slap on the wrist, where he did not want to strip states of their ability to rebuild their governments. So what happened in those 2 years was that a lot of Southern states passed something called Black Codes, which were specific laws meant to govern the movement of newly freed Black people. The Republicans at the time, which are, you know, what we would call the progressive Democrats of today, but radical Republicans of that time, said it's not enough. And they, at the federal level, began to implement policies and changes that saw more Blacks being sent to, using their vote, being sent to state legislatures, and eventually even into Congress for the next 10 years. So Reconstruction ends in 1877 by agreement. That agreement was based on the election of Rutherford B. Hayes. We get through the Grant presidency and things are changing. The 13th, 14th, or 15th Amendment are passed. And some people are like, it's moving too fast. We don't want this change. We don't want the Blacks lording over us. So you had rogue bands of former ex-Confederate slaves that become the predecessors to what we understand is the Klan, the Knights of the White Camellia, and these other vigilante groups. You also have the emergence of vigilante violence, racialized, targeted violence against Blacks based on stereotypes, if not outright lies, of criminal acts to justify terroristic killings. Are we all there?
Yeah, we're all there.
I mean,
it's a lot.
It's the same thing we're seeing right now.
I mean, yeah.
I don't know why it keeps repeating itself, but this is the same combination where you have people who are being very retaliatory and they don't even know why. You can say it's criminalized. Okay, they did some type of a crime or whatever, but what they found over and over and what we're going to get into with Ida B. Mm-hmm. and her crusade was when you pull out numbers and data, statistics, the mindset that your big threat are these black people then and now these brown people now.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't add up, but that's what
the data literally didn't support it. So she attracted a lot of attention because she had the discipline to do the research behind the sensationalism in some of the journal, some of the newspapers' journalism. Mm-hmm. And also she had the capacity to search out the correlation between the cause and the effect.
Mm-hmm.
This is why her work is important. And this is why we reference it. So going back to the end of Reconstruction, let's just talk about culturally some things that are just kind of pervasive at the time. This mob and vigilante violence, these rumors of criminality are based on the fact that large groups of whites, the majority, had the power to use language to disparage this whole entire group. So even during slavery, you had stereotypes about people that were not directly supported by what you use them for, i.e., blacks are shiftless and lazy, mm-hmm. yet you are working them 16 to 18 hours a day,
right.
In all sorts of capacities and tasks and industries. You're hiring them out. They are actually worth more than, if we put a young male slave that was able to be sold for $1,500, let's say in 1850. That $1,500 in today's dollars is like buying a Range Rover. Like, these are not cheap possessions. These mm-hmm. are not things that you just kind of trifle with and throw away. They were being insured. Mm-hmm. Okay. So even if you killed your property, you had losses, you could then file a claim and get a check so you could get another one, like it was a car, mm-hmm. okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this contributes to the dehumanization of black bodies and the black experience. But yet, and we've talked about this before, you're dehumanizing it, but you're also commoditizing the black womb. We're giving birth to your wealth. So it's a lot of real twisted stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Those first 10 years of Reconstruction tried a little, probably overzealously, like throwing paint at a wall, mm-hmm. to right all of those wrongs. And of course, you're not going to be able to do that. Culture is very, very strong. So regardless of losing the war, which instantly gave people an emotional wound of having lost, we never really quantify how many people were waiting for their ship to come in to belong to this landed gentry planter class. And a lot of these people who never got to do that, all they had was really their whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
So whiteness becomes the factor that unites Southern whites against other groups that they need to have their psychological standing maintained. And that needs to be transferred into a physical standing. So it's not enough for them to just personally think that they're better than newly freed blacks. They now have to implement that through policy and through action.
And all that coding.
And all that coding.
And I mean, all the coding. I mean, to the point where it makes you wonder, like, were the white Southerners even capable of making money without black bodies?
Right.
And I'm sorry, but it constantly looks like you couldn't survive without this free labor.
Right.
So
now
then,
you could have paid it. Now
you could have paid them.
As we get an understanding of how much money was really generated.
Like the prison industrial system.
Exactly. Like
it's a lie.
So you don't want to pay them, but then you want to say they're shiftless and lazy, but they're the ones that are making you finances. And then when they show even a little sign of economic progression, like Black Wall Street,
it incites rage.
Then you're mad, and then you have to go torching stuff.
Yeah,
and killing people and hanging them from trees. It's like, why not work? It's almost like looking at their argument of why not work for what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then why not work for what you're asking for? Yourself, earn everything yourself, pull yourself up by those bootstraps instead of holding all of your wealth on. Well, I would have more money if it wasn't for these black people, these brown people who are not working for me for free.
Right. Well, I mean, so not to go back, but it's rooted in, and this was always an issue for poor Southern whites, that their labor was undercut by a free labor system. So now that free labor, which they might have right or wrongfully thought was higher skilled than their own labor, because think of how it was implemented. Now you have competition in the market. Like, this is straight up an economics question. So by the end of 1877, or by 1877 rather, in an effort to unify the country, because now you have Southern Democrats repelling Reconstruction. They are repelling blacks using the franchise. They are holding very, very close to stereotypes, especially sexualized stereotypes of black people, especially black men, and that white women are in grave danger from potential sexual impropriety and rape from black men. They put out these stereotypes to justify this emergence of mob violence, like incident-based mob violence. So lynching, as well as arson, emerge as the preferred methods of this specific type of domestic terrorism. Okay, so lynching becomes so popular after the Civil War, all the way through the early 20th century, mm-hmm. that it becomes a part of Southern culture, meaning there was no shame in the action. So we have memorabilia, we have postcards, we have posters, we placemats, have greeting cards, we have art. We have things mm-hmm. that people used to buy and display in their home, or talk to, you know, I want to send a card to my cousin in California from Georgia, and I'm going to send them a postcard of a black person mutilated and hanging from a tree. Or a bridge, or, you know, a structure.
Well, these are community gatherings, remember? Yeah. You know, like, everyone, we're going to have a picnic, that type of thing, and here we go.
Just come to a public hanging.
Yeah. With your kids. Right. With your kids.
The mindset was that they were upholding law and order. Like, a lot of these phrases have not gone anywhere.
No,
that
not
this
at
is
all.
How we are policing our communities. We're actively taking a role in making sure that our families are safe, even though, again, the data to support these fears is non-existent.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So the real important thing is that lynching, by its very nature, was meant to be done outside of the confines of law and order. So it goes unchallenged as long as nobody is taking a systematic look at the phenomenon. This is where Wells makes her biggest impact. Okay, so why was lynching bad besides the fact that it was bad? It was extrajudicial, meaning that all it took was an accusation. That mm-hmm. sounds familiar. Mm-hmm. Okay. All it took was an accusation and this desire to make an example out of the accused. The problem is there was not always an initial accusation of a crime. What she was able to determine was that more than 2/3 of lynchings were done without an accusation of rape. Mm-hmm. Usually the discourse around the event, when mm-hmm. people took the time to speak to these gatherings of sometimes small groups, sometimes groups that included over 500, 1,000 people to watch this ritualistic murder of a black body, to desensitize you, to make you feel like it's normal, and to show you that this
is not a human.
It's not a human. It's not to be respected. And we are above whatever law that would keep us from behaving in this way.
You know, like putting kids in cages.
Things are happening. It's extrajudicial, which is actually a threat to our Constitution. Ultimately, you are not allowing people due process mm-hmm. under the law. This is in direct conflict with the 14th Amendment. It's not even being tested at this point in time to this extent. But one thing that Wells became aware of as she expanded her world, her own worldview, her own personal experience, is that everybody was not being treated the same, regardless if she was just only in Mississippi or if she had gone over to Memphis. She grew mm-hmm. her career in Memphis. She actually had a case prior to Plessy versus Ferguson about a train ticket. She bought a ticket on a train that she could afford for first class passage. And when she boarded the train, they attempted to not only put her in a Negro car, but they also wanted to put her in a woman's only section mm-hmm. in that car. And when she was accosted, she bit the hand of the train conductor. So she could have gone to jail herself. But this happened in 1884. Plessy's not until 1896. This is an example of black women doing things and it being pushed to the back, to the side. We've talked about us leading from behind. Now imagine if Plessy versus Ferguson was Wells versus whoever this train conductor was. Women don't even have the vote yet. They don't have, you know, well-defined property rights. They don't have autonomy in society yet. Yeah. So it's almost as if her action was overlooked, much like a Claudette Colvin. It just didn't fit what the overall narrative was going to be.
And that's overwhelmingly her whole work, is that but the voices of those families are not being heard. You don't hear, like, what happened? How did this person end up as a strange fruit, you know, figure here? With her being a woman, and that she actually did this before Plessy. I mean, you taught me something new today. Before Plessy versus Ferguson. But the fact that she did that, but she's not written into the story. Mm-mm. That's her whole thing, was I'm going to tell the story. Yes. I'm going to make sure that those voiceless people, they actually have their stuff written down, and we're going to have facts to back this up.
So that's what she does. So you mentioned Memphis. She moved to Memphis, and she began research one of her writings. And so she's now traveling the country collecting data that does not exist on lynchings.
Exactly.
And so she's going to get the statistics to bring back to Wright. She gets back home to Memphis, and a friend of hers, Thomas Moss, a local businessman, store owner, is lynched with three other men on March 5th, 1892. Okay.
Three store owners.
So at this time, she's 30. She's either 30 or about to turn 30. And this is where she deepens her passion, because they were lynched for economic reasons. They were store owners. There was no preceding accusation of a crime or even a rape, even though newspapers at the time would sensationalize that these things happened because these people were purported to be that. A lynching victim, regardless of the actual circumstances of their crime, at this point in time, you do not have such strong journalistic standards that certain newspapers, just like today, wouldn't participate in sensationalism. We're going to talk about this. We're going to distort some of the details because it's going to sell papers. It's a business. So when this happens to her friends, and she realizes that her friends cannot be disparaged as, you know, rapists or criminals, it that lights her spark.
Yeah, she started to question whether you could live in the South. And because she was an author, her questioning was written down so people could see and spread, and that became a problem for the local citizens. And so they broke into her business, torched it, and
left a note
saying, if we see you here again, you're gonna die. And so she goes to New York, and New York is where we get the first real, like, sledgehammer from Ida B. Wells in the form of The Southern Horrors, Law in All Its Phases. So she releases this book, which is catalog of all of these lynchings that have taken place and everything that's going on in the South. And this becomes one of her seminal works before the follow up to this. And this is the start, because she was a journalist under her pen name, right?
Yes, Iola. Yes.
Now, keep in mind, she's pulling from newspaper articles. And if the trend is that people are either having their businesses burned and they happen to be Black, or they're being hanged from trees. This is not hidden. This reporting could have been done.
Yeah.
The fact that she had the, I'm going to tell this story, frankly, some bleeding heart liberal white person could have been done this story.
But she couldn't get their audience. So by this time, America kind of has a fatigue when it comes to Blacks and self-determination and civil rights. And it happens in cycles. It happens every time we make progress. People be like, isn't that enough?
If you had a story on fracking and it kept being another story on fracking, then you have a trend. So that's an option that newsrooms are making to not cover this. They had options. I don't care.
I feel like they were covering it, but they were... certain newsrooms were covering it to the extent of the distortion and the sensationalism. I don't think these things were completely ignored, but they were not in the proper arena for the level of crime that it was. To have vigilante violence throughout the South means that you have roving units of people who believe that they are above even their local or state law enforcement. So what happens after Reconstruction that kind of kept a lid on things was that federal troops were there. So you usually fight a war, usually like what is happening overseas now in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're talking about pulling out. So it's the same idea. When Union troops kind of pulled out their major forces, they left remnants to keep the peace, mm-hmm. to not even directly to protect the interests of newly freed blacks or blacks who are trying to establish, but to keep the peace. The compromise of 1876, which is the compromise that put Hayes in office, was that those federal troops would be removed from the South, which means that now nobody was there to stop them from implementing things like poll taxes, grandfather clauses to exclude you from the vote, which immediately whitened the state legislatures and whitened their presence in Congress. You no longer had the threat of federal intervention into local affairs. So it's this continuation of this narrative of states' rights and the rights of the property owner, the rights of...
But journalists are journalists. States' rights be, you know, damned already. If you're in the North and you're seeing all this trend happen and you're not covering it, that's you sleeping on the job. I don't care if it's 18-something or 19-something or 2000-something.
That's true.
So they opted not to cover it. You see a trend happening, you're ignoring it. Okay. And then she comes along and she literally was just pulling newspaper clips.
And one thing that she was able to demonstrate was that, you know, we talked about the mm-hmm. fact that 2/3 were never even accused of a crime. The other phenomenon that she captured in collecting that data was that the lynchings are happening outside of places that used to be known as the South. Mm-hmm. So you have lynchings happening up into the Midwest. You have them mm-hmm. happening in remote, Chicago. Yeah, in remote places. So she was able to further this idea that this specific crime was meant to be a racial deterrent to progress. Yep. This was not meant to be even a criminal punishment. This was meant to be terrorism.
Yeah. Her quote from her journal was, "Lynching, an excuse to get rid of Negroes who are acquiring wealth and property and thus keep the race terrorized and keep the nigger down."
Mm-hmm.
Literally, like I wrote in my own notes, I was like, there's this thing called the lynching lie. And like you were saying, it was seen as being a punishment. Mm-hmm. But if there's no connection to a crime, then all you're doing is trying to literally keep this section of people in their place with air quotes all over that. That alone, you know, that's her whole crusade. And I mean, anyone could have picked up this data. It was not hidden from anyone. It's just a fact that news organizations opted not to.
It's will. We constantly are talking about, do you have the will to do what is right? And there are other things, you know, we keep bringing up economics, but you also have to understand the United States is going through a recession at this point toward the end of the 19th century.
Well, that never
helps. You also have an emergence of there's a large scale social change because there's more potential labor in the labor force now. Mm-hmm. So people wanted to maintain a social order. They, you know, this idea of moving blacks only into domestic or technical trades, having them constantly work for. You have an emergence of now new leaders who are saying, this is how we can further integrate into this community. Here's how we can be helpful. One of the most notable people who carried that type of narrative and that type of policy line is Booker T. Washington, who is the Hampton graduate, himself mixed race, himself a leader of school intended to educate Negroes. But his policy line that made him famous was that we'll get farther if we don't try to disrupt directly the order that is trying to be implemented. This puts him in direct conflict with W.E.B. Du Bois, who says, we ain't got time for that. You know what I'm saying? Who brings an equally problematic concept to the fore with the Talented 10th, explaining that only 10% of African Americans are going to be able to participate in the best institutions and lead in the best trades, jobs, industries, and that they should be doing that to affect policy. Like, the only 10% of us are going to be able to do the work of pulling the other 90% along. So these two people are at odds. But what is interesting is that behind the both of them is the work of Ida B. Wells.
Yeah. So she ends up in Chicago mm-hmm. in 1895 and releases the follow-up, which is an expansion on Southern Horrors. It's called The Red Record. And from this, she starts to develop this acclaim, which lands her in Europe,
mm-hmm.
where, here's the thing. We saw in the 2016 election how mm-hmm. our racism was viewed around the world as a weakness to us. That has always been the case. So Ida B. Wells is in Europe and they look at us and see what's going on, because there's an element in Europe that knows that wants the American experiment to fail, because that's where we came from. You can't do this. This is, you shouldn't have left. We had the war or whatever. So they're looking at what we're doing out loud. Everyone can see this. Everyone can see this stain. And so she's over there doing the work. She comes back and there's a lot of work to do. Now we have organizations forming like the YMCA, Christian organization. And she has she has issues there. That was a Methodist organization that they formed. And the NAACP. So we got to talk about the controversy at the NAACP.
So the whole full disclosure is that I do write for the Crisis, part of the NAACP. So I might be let's not put
Nikki on the spot.
But I will say that Ida B. Wells Barnett, her whole career has been pointing out what is not right, or pointing out what is right there, and maybe it doesn't go along with the whole "let's go along to get along" mindset to get further, which is often the phrase of respectability politics.
Right.
I 100% agree with that. Like, okay, if the idea is that if we think we can put a suit on or educate our ways out of racism, it just hasn't worked yet. And I don't think it's ever going to work.
No, I think that's the busy work that keeps you from the real work of the progress. Because you're concerned about how good you look as opposed to how good you are.
And the suits are not bulletproof. Suits do not protect your neck from a noose.
Nope.
So Ida B. Wells, as the NAACP is forming, Ida B. Wells is there.
Yes.
She is.
She is a major contributor.
Yep.
And as long as people think that they can co-opt and take responsibility for her methods, she is relatively welcome behind the scenes to do the heavy lifting, goes back to the surrogacy piece, that, you know, we'll let you do all of the work, but we won't give you any of the credit. Eventually, because she was a talented writer and journalist, she was talented at chasing down the story. People wanted her on the case. They wanted her to continue to produce the data that would allow the platform to continue to expand on why an NAACP would be necessary, and why, even if they're disparate, as these new Black leaders are coming to the forefront, they needed something to talk about. They needed something to back them up. So the fact that there was a lynching phenomenon, her friends were lynched in 1892. This period of her review goes all the way to 1930. Mm-hmm. So there's not any let up in the use of this method. If anything, there is rage against it being identified for what it is. Her contemporary T. Thomas Fortune referred to her as a bull in the in a china shop. He said she would be much better suited as a man to lead, because nobody would have a problem with it if she was a man. But because she was very direct, very forthright, the critiques always came back to how unladylike she was.
And that was then. This, and yet here we hear it today.
Well, the same thing actually happened to Dorothy Height, just as a different example. Dorothy Height is present at all of the major pivotal moments of the mid-century civil rights movement, up to and including assuming leadership, not only over Delta Sigma Theta, but also NCNW, the National Council of Negro Women. Yet and still, her work was isolated and held to the side. She was not fully integrated into this story where you hear names like King and Abernathy and other people Rustin. You don't even hear Height as much as we are now, you know, raising the profile of Rustin, even though he, you know, was a queer man. Mm-hmm. So this intentional pushing back into the shadows of Black women, even though they were doing the work. You know, we talked about the suffragette march in 1913.
Where she literally decided, no, I'm going to walk in the front.
Yeah, and Delta was there. You know,
at a time when, well, I mean, that's part of the founding, so
Delta was there, and we were there.
Both members in this room are Delta, so just put that out there now.
I mean, and you're welcome. You're welcome, y'all. But it's important because not only was it integral to our founding, but it is the key reason why we're here, because that social justice had to be about more than lip service. So yeah, Ms. Wells, our soror, was one of these manifestations of how we do this work. Mm-hmm. So
I always pointed out the fact that I think I'm really blessed, plus I'm privileged. I have a degree in African American studies. I had to sit down and have entire, like, three courses on the role of Black women in our history, Pan-African diaspora across the board. But when you step back and realize that the common Joe Blow Schmo, whatever education system you went through, all they can do is memorize the Malcolms and the Martins of the world. Mm-hmm. So the Black woman's existence has been pushed to, oh, they were supportive. We all know how Rosa Parks rolled in NAACP. We also know that during, like, the Little Rock Nine, you know, the importance of Daisy. So there's people throughout history, there are strong Black women throughout history that they're just now getting their shine because we're pushing this. Ida B. Wells is one of the people that should have been always a part of that whole Booker T conversation.
She should be a household name.
She should have been part of that for a while. It should not have been like last year, or was it even this year when she got to like the street in Chicago? But where you have to push our history, otherwise other people will write our history. Mm-hmm. And again, that's again taking her legacy, and the reason why I idolize her so much is that I'm not going to sit by and wait for someone else to tell my story. I'm going to tell my story. I want to make sure that our people's story is not manipulated into, oh, well, there was this one rabble rouser and, you know, bull in the china shop. That shows you right there that a woman's place, big air quotes on that, it's still questioned back then and now.
Yeah, I mean, the NAACP took her platform. They adopted the anti-lynching. So she started in New York with the first release, in Chicago with the second, in Europe. This is the anti-lynching campaign is Ida B. Wells Barnett platform. That is what she. So the NAACP, as they're standing up, they're saying, hey, we need something strong. This is perfect. Everyone knows about this. We don't like getting lynched. Let's bring this in and help, you know, help champion this cause. Mm-hmm. But this bull in a china shop metaphor is because she's not taking shit for social justice. She's not stepping to the back. She's actually trying to be out front, leading and pushing the platform. She's not gonna let them take her platform and do something that she knows should be done. They're gonna do something the wrong way, and she was fighting against that. Mm-hmm. And so she got the reputation because she was protecting the platform that she built. The NAACP fought against that. And she had to step away.
This is no different than the women who lead Black Lives Matter. This is no different than Tarana Burke, where Black Twitter had to give her flowers, had to make sure she got her credit when all of majority Twitter wanted to credit Alyssa Milano. It's like literally like you got to the party an hour late.
Yeah. Well, my
4 hours late.
My favorite line will always be "Not your mule." I'm sorry. If we're doing the work, it's time we claim the work. I'm not saying be, you know, gauche and be very braggadoche. But the reality is, if this is something that I've been doing for a while, like Ida B. Wells had been doing for a while, it's hard to co-opt that when she has books out.
Right.
Like, she has literature done. This is a continuous pattern. Any organization can pick it up, but she's got the receipts.
General culture, though. So it's just, to me, it's just the strength of general culture. Even her having the books and being known for her research and being known for her work. This is already going against the general culture that's like, let your husband speak for you. You know what I mean? As a matter of fact, in her personal life, she might have been concerned, you know, will she ever have the trappings of what people thought real womanhood would be? Would there be a husband? Would there be children? All of those things came. She is really a strong role model for the modern working woman. She had them kids, she got married, and she got right back out there.
I was still an investigative journalist. And before that, I mean, people knew that was a thing. I mean, she's going around doing the work in a way that, I mean, we have to respect, like you're saying, Nikki, like the fact that she did what she did and wrote it down means that even though that history can be ignored for centuries, it's still written down.
Exactly.
We can still refer to it, and someone can go and dig that up and say, oh, I heard somebody mentioned Ida B. Wells, and they can read what she said, what was going on. And that is one of the great things about a person like that and the history that we have, because a lot of stuff is still to be uncovered.
One of the lasting legacy of what she actually contributed was that She gave real insight to this concept of white rage. You know it exists, but can you prove it? So by approaching, yeah, the numbers don't lie. Men lie, women lie, numbers don't lie. So by doing the data research and creating that data and plotting it out and putting herself out there for the ridicule and for the mistreatment, not only for her gender, but also for her race, she was able to document white rage. It continues to be important because even now we are trying to figure out, quote unquote, what is happening to prominent activists in protest movements who are turning up dead. There is
and
history
people will tell
that
you coincidence.
Oh, it's like, what is it?
Mississippi Burning. I mean, there with the freedom riders and stuff.
We haven't evolved past this. We haven't evolved past this because these extrajudicial killings continue to be effective.
And
so
let me put you into a newsroom situation, mm-hmm. since I know everything's going to be from a scholarly standpoint and a biblical, which is great. But on the newsroom side of all this is painfully annoying because I'm sitting there. I have the attributes of, okay, you're black, you're a woman, you're younger than everybody else in the room sometimes. And their mindset is like, well, you have to prove that this was racially motivated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm covering the 2016 election. I'm seeing, like, young black bodies being shoved around a rally.
Mm-hmm.
And a girl is holding her backpack and she's being shoved around like a pinball. And they're like, oh, well, that's just how they act in protest. No, that's not normally a rally thing.
Us being able... and taking,
like, you see that,
yeah, but
you know
us
that.
Taking the power in telling our own story, us reporting from our perspective demystifies and takes the power out of that ambiguity. And we've talked about that. When the oppressed person is talking, the story is going to sound different. So we get to say that is targeted violence fueled by her gender and by, or, you know, by
and
her
I
sex
spent, I spent
and
most
by
of the
her
2016
race.
Election literally having to explain that, like, this is definitely not normal.
Yeah.
I've covered elections before. I've seen people disrupt a room before. They're pushing her around like she's not a human.
And then when people don't have the historical background or not willing to consider the historical record, there's this tendency to view events in a vacuum. You want to view 2016 in a vacuum, but you don't want to view it as a continuation of what has been happening over hundreds of years when it comes to the confrontation of black progress.
So bringing it back to Ida B. Wells, that's why I'm not giving anyone like a pass because it was so early in journalism history.
Mm-hmm.
No, if the reports were all out there, all these scattered reports, but every last one of these reports says burn, torch a building, burn, torch a person, hang somebody. This is a pattern. And you can't use that as, oh, that's just how they do justice down there. Okay, you're a bleeding heart white liberal up in New York City, Chicago, or insert whatever place you think is progressive. You're going to look at all of this happening and say, oh, I'm just going to like slide past this trend, this pattern. No.
So let me ask you a journalism question.
Mm-hmm.
In over 200 years ago, Ida B. Wells, she has something to say. She has a story that needs to be told, and she has to make her own platform.
Good.
She has to find... she has to publish herself. Have we made much progress since then?
Nope.
We don't own things.
Okay.
If you don't own it, then you really cannot control the message.
Sorry.
And so she had to go independently publish stuff. And I think it was her history, her reputation that made people take it in. Like, okay, she had a consistent history of, she does data-driven reporting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, she's just sitting there saying, let me talk about the plight of the black man. And she's not doing a Tariq Nasheed or something like that. You know, she's giving you facts. And you can't contest with facts. She's got stuff in the back. You know, like, she you can't contest. You cannot fight with this. And I think that's why when she was self-published, people were like, okay, you know what? That's Ida B. Wells. She always has information on that.
Mm-hmm.
I get that reaction when I post something.
And she understood the value of her absence. So when she began to, so it wasn't always that she was being pushed out. There were times where she said, I ain't going.
Yeah.
So where she was able to deepen her roots and establish more of her prominence was instead of fighting these other men for national prominence, she doubled down on her presence in Illinois, Chicago especially. So
she had clout.
She had it, but it's like she was able to understand the value of her presence. You know, sometimes people stay on a sinking ship or, you know, in a disparate situation because they've been sold that, you know, their sacrifice is better. You know, just be obedient to what's happening over there.
And you're part of the greater
she
good.
She bucked that whole, okay. She turned that whole thing on its ear.
So not much has changed. How are, in 2019, Black women journalists finding avenues to tell their stories? Because I believe that there are other stories to be told and are trying to be told. So I would like to find those stories. I wouldn't like to have to go wait 200 years to figure it out. Where are Black women telling these stories in the absence of a medium that does push those narratives?
Yeah, because everyone wants to go to, like, a lot of my alma maters, the BETs and TV ones, and say, okay, well, you're Black, so you have Black news. And they're kind of like going right past the lovely internet that offers infinite opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on what age group you're talking to, honestly. But if you're owned by a corporation, I'm not going to name any of them because I probably get checks from them. But if you're owned by a corporation that has a history of quieting and silencing our voices, then I can't see you going very far. If you can go independent, go independent, but go independent. Make sure that you are a journalist that can be respected, or a journalist that someone can look at your work and say, you know, have some ethics, please. If it's going to be a whole bunch of like, I'm going to pontificate and I'm going to be a talking head, then understand that you are going to be seen as literally you are a talking head. You have a point of view. We all do. I'm not going to lie. And editorials do have a place in journalism, but most of us earn our chops not because of our editorial work, but because the fact that we were doing, you know, just the facts first. From there, you can bridge and grow. We have a lot of branding going on. So when you see somebody with a massive following, it's normally for a reason. And sadly, right now, the consumer is having a hard time, the media consumer is having a hard time deciphering, well, what is journalism and what is a progressive voice or an intellectual thinker? And I spend more time trying to tell people, like, that's a person that does some really great work and they write some really great books. But if you ask them if they're reporting on anything, they're not. At least with Ida B. Wells, what you were looking at was she gave you facts. She gave you facts to back up the first, you know, part of her nut graph that said this is what's going on in America. White rage is leading to them killing Black people and torching our economic establishments like Black Wall Street. Today is a painful situation because even the most progressive and like the people that I enjoy, like their work, they're still under the thumb of whoever owns them or pays their bills. And they have to go through a manager the same way. It's not until you're an independent. And that's, I guess, why at this point in my career, which I felt like it accelerated so fast. But at this point, I'm like, I'm trying to do more independently just because I'm so tired of begging to tell our story. And unless I'm talking about the arts, which I do love, I can always get somebody to pat me on the back to do a story about the arts. But when I want to talk about, okay, can we talk about modern day lynchings and how this stuff is okay? And y'all are just brushing it off. Then I got to go through all that internal stuff that's happening in said manager's mind where they can justify or explain away, well, I don't see it as racist because I remember spending 2 years where racist was like the worst thing you could call somebody. And I'm like, but it's racist, though. Like, you know, I feel like a meme. That right there is racist. What he's saying right there is racist. What they're doing right there is racist. And I'm sitting here finally, you know, 2 years later, you're looking at Charlottesville. And I'm like, told you so. He just ran a car into a whole bunch of people. I mean, what else do you, the tiki torches and the khaki shorts, that didn't do it for you. Like, I'm confused as to having to always, as a Black journalist, having to always explain it. You know, have to put on a Ron Burgundy voice and I have to, like, you know, burn my hair up and do all this stuff to conform, to make you comfortable, like to go along, to get along, like all this comes together. And still, when I'm trying to tell you that something is blatantly racist and harmful and goes against what y'all say you're into because your cousin, uncle, brother, whoever are fine people. They're feeling it personally. Well, I'm feeling it personally too.
Well, I mean, it's a complex it leads you back into some conversations that we've even had before, mm-hmm. where, like, as you're talking, I'm thinking about when Al Roker was at the Rio Olympics and Ryan Lochte.
Like, he was just a boy. Like,
he's
like,
yeah, and he was 32. And right. Roker was like over it. And he was over it. And, but the clip was so dynamic and powerful because I think it resonated with people who were like, I'm tired of telling you what my experience is. I know what I know what I know.
And think about how old Al Roker is. Like, I have seen and talked to this man enough times to tell you that he has gotten to the level where he mm-hmm. can literally tell you, he can tell you off now. And he owns his own production company. He's making his other money elsewhere in the event that somebody gets real crafty and creative at the big job and says, all right, You can't be here. We've had enough. Like, all right, fine. He's got Al Roker money and Al Roker independent projects, and he knows he's our elder. He knows that I need to have my own.
And I think the emergence of ownership is to reclaim some of that.
Yeah.
But because it's not always about race, and then sometimes it's about class, you can run into those barriers again. So it's a constant fight. But we've talked about Black women leading from behind because we see the whole room because we're in the back of it. Mm-hmm. You might want to trust what we're saying.
And people don't. I mean, you would think that the impact on that Alabama
election
would have been like enough to make people pay more attention. It's not a fad.
And we ain't finna save y'all again. We not about to do that.
Yeah, we will. We always do. Sad part.
Thank you very much for joining us for... No, this is great. I learned a lot. I feel like I'm not prepared for the quiz. I got to go over my notes.
But Mira had the whole timeline and stuff. I can just tell you about blackness and lynching.
I do the same thing with church. So watching you do this on history is the same. I love it.
Thanks.
I eat this up. So thank you, Nikki. I want to tell the folks where they can find you. Where can we find Nikki Mayo?
You can always find Nikki Mayo at Nikki Mayo News on my website, social media accounts and everything like that. It's always the same, Nikki Mayo News. And hashtag journal life. If you follow either one of those two, you'll definitely find me.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.